Hi, and welcome to the IDEMS podcast. I'm David Stern, director of IDEMS, and it's my pleasure to be here with Kate Fleming, another director. Hi, Kate.
Hey, David.
What should we discuss today? I was thinking we could dig into the textbook work we've been doing and some of the experiences from the recent conferences I've been to.
I am very curious to hear what the reaction was. We did a lot of work thinking about the stats textbooks and really how we communicate that vision to other people. And I am curious to hear how it landed, where you found interest. Are people really understanding what the problem is, what the innovation is, all of those different pieces? So, yeah, I guess I'll let you kind of kick it off.
I think let's start then with the statistics conference. Myself and Lily went to the ICOTS conference. This is the International Conference on Teaching Statistics. It was in Australia. If you want, it's the premier conference. It happens once every 4 years of the statistics data science education community. And of course, this year was dominated by AI. Everybody was talking about AI. The textbooks that we put forward, actually, there was an interesting response. And there was one talk in particular where the first question really highlighted the work we put in was worthwhile. And that question was, well, I think there's something game-changing here, but I don't know that I understand what it is. And that enabled us to actually then try and articulate better what is so foundationally different about what we were proposing compared to what others are doing.
And that's a helpful reaction for us. And I think that was what we were hoping to get, where we're giving people enough, but then they're able to say, well, I don't understand this. How does this work? What does this do? But you started with AI was the topic on everyone's minds and lips, I assume. I'd like to come back to in what ways? I assume there's fear. What does that fear look like? There's optimism. What does that optimism look like? To really understand what those conversations were. And we can dig into those more and maybe dig into them in the context of our textbooks thinking and work.
Maybe actually that's a good place to start because, of course, in statistics and data science, the big thing which has changed over the last few years is the fact that you can now use these large language models to write the scripts to do an analysis. And students are doing this. Lecturers are trying to deal with, well, if we don't need to teach people to code anymore, what are we teaching people? Because in the past, a lot of effort has gone to teaching people how to write code. And now the large language models can do that for you. You just tell them what you want to do and it'll write the code. And so that was really one of the big topics. How do we allow and enable students to take advantage of this while actually making sure that they are gaining skills and actually learning? And of course, the big question on that is, are we able to get it so that students learn more thanks to these technologies, or are they going to learn less because they're not thinking? And that's the real question on everyone's mind.
And was there any arc of people's thinking over the week where at the end of the week, people came out less optimistic, where there was more vision for how students do learn better? Is it just that the world is changing and that's how things have always been and you sort of evolve and focus in different directions? And maybe it means that educators need different skills too. What did that look like?
I guess whether there was an arc through the week, one of the things I think which was clear is everyone came out knowing things they didn't know before. For example, it was really interesting to see colleagues from very wealthy US universities discuss the issue with institutional licenses for the latest large language models and simply saying that spending hundreds of dollars per student is no longer enough to allow them to have access to the latest models. So what are we going to do?
Nice problem to have.
Yes, exactly. This is the thing. The cost increase was an interesting issue there. But I think the other thing which was really eye-opening for many others who are not in that high-resource environment was the fact that actually having access to the latest models versus models which are even 6 months, a year out of date, is huge in terms of the skill of those systems to be able to write code, to do analysis. It is so much better that not having access to those latest models is seen as really putting your students at a disadvantage by these high resource institutions. And therefore, one of the things I think a lot of people came out with was this element that, because a lot of other people around the world were using the free tier models and just their students were using whatever is freely available, that awareness that there's this huge difference between the performance they're getting and their students having access to and what is actually at the cutting edge. That was, I think, eye-opening to other people as well.
And that is such a real-world example of, I think, what people have been talking about for a while, which is this two-tier world that can emerge as the people who can afford to access just the latest cutting-edge technology start to move in one direction and everyone else gets left behind. Whether it plays out that way, I mean, you could imagine that there are things that emerge from lean resources and people using models differently or AI differently. Who knows what happens? But that's definitely a fork in the road as you're describing it.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, part of where our discussions came in on this, because a lot of what we do is trying to say, well, how do we build for these low resource environments? And can we build for the low resource environments so that there is an element of actually we have what is needed and maybe pedagogically more valuable than just making sure you have access to the latest models? And I think that's really the piece that I'd like to dig into a little bit around this, because it emerged very clearly that the big issue with using the simple out-of-the-box large language models, whether it's your latest models or your free versions, is that they're not designed for pedagogy. They're not designed to help learning. They're designed for doing. And yes, doing is a good way to learn, but actually what the experiences people are having is that many students are not learning because the cognitive load is being taken by the models in ways that are not constructive. And actually, the results they're getting at the end are both not ideal and they haven't had the learning processes. And so what I think is emerging is the fact that actually, if we designed these multi-agent systems for learning, using the less expensive models, we could probably achieve better educational outputs than with the more expensive models, and they could be scalable. So this is, I think, one of the really exciting things which to me emerged. And I guess this does relate to the textbook work we've had, although it's sort of slightly tangentially related to this. I'll get there in a minute, because the key observation that I had time and time again in these discussions is that everybody who's actually doing the educational research around this broadly are identifying, well, it's not actually what the models do, it's how the students interact with the models that really counts for learning. And so this is something where we can design for that. With a multi-agent system, we can design to support the right type of student interactions. And then almost independently, there's what the models actually are doing and what they're returning. But we can actually build in these processes in the multi-agent system, which ensure that there are better interactions with students for learning.
I also hear in that two layers of learning, where part of what you are teaching is the foundational data science, statistics, you're teaching those skills. But also, I mean, this has been a problem with tech for many years. There's this idea of digital natives, which basically is a fancy way of saying you're good consumers of tech, but you don't actually understand what it is. And so it's celebrated by companies because it's like, oh, we've built these little users of this new innovation, and they don't really think about what's going on under the hood. And a lot of what I hear in this is, how do you build into your teaching that you are not creating AI natives and all that euphemism and all that's hidden in it, but you're actually teaching really valuable skills about how AI works, what its limitations are, what kinds of decisions it's making that might be at odds at times with what you're actually trying to achieve, whatever it is. So there's a complexity that's coming to teaching. There are just so many more new problems that people are trying to navigate here.
Absolutely. I want to come to one of the key points that you've just drawn out, which actually came up quite a lot. What are the limitations of the technology? And actually, this is something which people talked about a lot. And yet, one of the things that I took away is that this is so transient. What we talked about last year in similar communities as the limitations of the technologies have broadly gone away, but there's a whole new set of limitations which have taken their place. And so it's actually the what of the limitations is a lot less important than the fact that there will always be some limitations. And that's something which I think is a subtle shift in how we can present this, how we can engage in this process. The reality that there are limitations versus the practicality of what those limitations are, I think is a really interesting distinction that, done right, we can build the fact that there will always be limitations and that that's recognized into the way that people interact and learn with this, rather than get people to focus on, well, what are the given limitations at this point of time, which might disappear when you use the latest and greatest technology, the next technology that comes along.
Well, it's interesting. I hear two different things in that, because one, you could imagine there's something that's quite evergreen that people are learning, and that is just like the practice and things you need to be aware of in how AI works or whatever. And then there will be things that are very timely where you want to learn something this year, and then whatever that lesson is will need to change next year. And that gets to where we think a lot about, well, and really what we're working on building, which is how do you have these much more malleable, adaptive, evolving textbooks so that you're not just constantly looking at investing, putting all this work into resources that are good right now and are basically completely obsolete in 6 months, in a year, or have some historic value. That's not what people are in class to learn, at least in most classes.
Yes, and I think the key thing there is that actually the piece of the textbooks which came out, which we've discussed in the past, these formative assessment, the exercises where we actually are software agnostic, these have become so much more valuable because in the context that we use them, people can use all sorts of different tools. And we've had in recent years people using AI to try and solve these problems. And the cognitive load is not diminished by the fact that the AI is actually building your script, because almost always the way the exercises are designed is that the problems in the analysis, these involve choices that you make in which analyses you do. And so those choices are still there, and they're there for you to make, or they're there for the AI to make. The fact that there is a right choice in a given context is context dependent, not something that a model can determine a priori necessarily. Yes, maybe you can give it all the context and then it could maybe actually look at this and understand it. But broadly, that's not how people are using these models for data analysis. So I'll just take the very simple example, which I love to give, of this missing value exercise, where if you calculate the summaries in one way, you get one answer. If you use and identify missing values in another way, you get a second answer. And if you identify missing values in a third way, you get a third answer. And one of those answers is contextually correct. But all three answers are correct from a sort of statistical standpoint, depending on the nature of those missing values in the context. And so, if you're only getting the analysis done by the AI, you're now exactly learning about the decisions you need to make based on the context and understanding the data you have. And so it's a perfect example, which is very simple and which works equally well for students using AI as it does for students using a stats package or writing R code or writing Python. So it doesn't matter. It's totally software agnostic. and you still get the pedagogical value. And this is something which I believe in the discussions that we've had in that particular conference, there was an appreciation, I think, emerging to moving beyond what has become the norm, which is to teach the coding of a statistical language like R or Python, and to actually go beyond that to really try to get people to think about analysis in context.
That's such an interesting example and such an interesting way of thinking about what AI, if really done well, can bring to all of us, is that we stop spending all of our time on tactical things and kind of mastering skills, and it should get us to better thinking. We're really getting to take a step back and analyze things more, think about why decisions get made, why is this being done this way, because you're just tired and you've put all your time into actually building the system that does the thing. And I think this is the vision when people really are idealistic about AI. That is what it is. It's like, well, it's advancing what humans are. It's getting us to do what we do best, which is much more critical thinking. And what's the application of this? And what are the implications? And what does it mean when we do this across different contexts? And then working back to what is the system that produced that answer and how might it need to be designed differently? You know, that's the thinking that's actually interesting. That's the application that's really the best use of human minds.
And this was brought out. There were a number of presentations about this where they discussed that actually what these AI systems are also doing is they're helping us to train managers, because actually managing AI agents is not that different to managing people that need to be able to look above and to be able to take responsibility for things which you're not doing yourself, and so on. There were a couple of talks which actually drew out the fact that there's real opportunities emerging here to train people for skills which industries want, these sort of middle manager skills, because that's part of what these multiple agent systems are giving people. They are making you the manager rather than the grunt.
And I would also say there are two kinds of managers, I think, very broadly. There is the managing and what we think of like sort of organizing, checking. You're using that sort of middle manager idea. I would also argue there is a sort of visionary manager, where it's somebody who's seeing, who's kind of forward looking. Where is this going? They're not just trying to tamp down the chaos or kind of keep order in the system. They're also identifying where is this going? How can we evolve this? All of these different things. Because I often hear manager and think, it doesn't feel, and I think some people would hear that too, where that doesn't necessarily feel like the, wow, that's a really exciting future where I just get to be this middle manager.
But it is that manager who is leading a team, being able to set the agenda for the team, make sure the team has the right tasks to get the right things done. This is very much the skills that are potentially coming out from students managing AI agents.
So back to textbooks then, and back to ICODS. When you think about the work we're doing and you think about it in the context of stats and data science textbooks, and really that this is the context where we can lean into the most ambitious kind of prestige side of the vision, how did that take shape for you over the week?
It was great. I mean, there were four or five authors of textbooks that Lily had converted who were there. And so engaging with them was already really interesting. And as you would expect, there was some skepticism initially, but all responses were positive. Once they understood what we were doing and why, all responses from all the textbook authors who were there and present were very positive. But more than that, there were a couple, one in particular, where once we went through and we explained it, broadly it was, this is exactly why I made my textbook open. I want it to be reused. I want others to be using it. I want it to be used in contexts that I know nothing about. And so there was a willingness, and we only pushed it in this one case because the door was open. But there was a willingness to then engage with adaptations, with variants of their book, to say, yeah, I could play the role of actually accrediting them and actually making sure that, yes, it is true to my understanding. But when people are creating their variants, I could say, yes, this is a valid variant of my book. So we already have at least one volunteer to take on that role. And that's really important because this is the role we'd love authors to then be able to play. It creates a positive interaction between them and the people who create variants of their books. And it potentially then helps those who create variants get recognition for what they've done. But that was just the beginning. The bit that was really exciting is that, of course, we had representatives of IASE, the International Association of Statistics Education. We had a representative of ISI, the International Statistics Institute. And we put to them their potential role to accredit books and to take an accreditation role at a different level, which is what we've always envisaged. You really want these communities of experts to be the ones who are able to give stamps of approval of different sorts. And that is something which actually we've been in touch with the executive committee of IASE. We've been in touch with certain people from ISI Academy, who are the natural accrediting body there, and there is interest. And so we still need to sort out what this would look like, but we now have engagement and interest with the right international bodies who could take on this role to give stamps of approval and accreditation in ways that I think could be so powerful. And this then, of course, has the potential to snowball. Lily is going to the Royal Statistics Society conference in a couple of months' time. If IASE is already on board, getting RSS on board and playing a different role, this has a natural approach to get these bodies to be playing the role that could help them as well as the system itself. So it really is, it felt really good to get this buy-in or this willingness to consider and to see, yes, not only do we appreciate what you're doing, but we're willing to contribute and we see how this could help us as an international body. It was great.
That is very positive. And we have been very aware that rather than just a wide church, wide net community, we are more helped at this phase by a really engaged, really informed by authors, by accreditors, who are those players who really help us understand deeply the behaviors, the needs, the level of willingness to participate at different levels so that we can build from that space. Because if we are trying to maintain impact standards, if we are saying this is high quality, this is consistently high quality, not that you couldn't eventually, someone could take it and do something with it, but that is not accredited necessarily. That's something different. And so we're really trying to figure out that core infrastructure, human and technical, that bounds standards. I hear a lot of that in this, in the different pieces and levels that you're describing in this.
No, absolutely. It did feel really good to get this buy-in from a wide set of members of the community. And I should just say, we do need people at the ground as well, lecturers, and we got some interest there as well. So we got interest, just little bits of interest from all levels. But it really felt like we actually, there's something big here, as was highlighted by this question. Others were able to see that, yes, this is potentially revolutionary. This is potentially really new and a game changer in terms of the nature of these stats textbooks. So watch this space. It's exciting.
Yeah, one other thing I just wanted to add about educators. Yes, definitely. They are so important. And I think what we see across in mathematics and other spaces too, it's the educators who are just really acutely feeling this problem. They want to do things better in their classrooms. It is a lot of work to do it on your own. And they're doing a lot of it on their own. But I think they're aware, well, this could be so much better if I were joining forces with other people who are also really motivated to solve these problems. So I think it's at every level. It's just the person who's already experiencing problems and then very motivated to engage with, well, how do we address them?
Well, maybe that's the right transition. This is going to be another episode because that's really what we were seeing then at the STAT conference in Kenya. where the shift was more than the stats textbooks, it was really the school level textbooks. And the interest in that and what's emerging there is really exciting and a whole nother episode.
Let's talk about it next.
Sounds great. All the best.
Thanks, David.